You're listening to Beyond the Jargon, a jargon-free look at graduate students and their research here at the University of Victoria. Well, as promised, here's the part two of the Colleen-Mario combo interview that we started last week. Enjoy!
This whole subject, like you said, of vulnerability and connection absolutely overlaps with psychology,
sure.
Which brings us to you.
Yes.
Can you tell our listeners exactly what your program is and what you're doing right at the moment, and then we'll go from there?
Yeah, so I'm in the Cognition and Brain Sciences program, technically, which is a sub-department in psychology, and it sounds super neurologistic, but it's not. It's not for me anyway. There are certain folks in the department who are very brain-focused, who do fMRI and EEG research and take pictures of brains and stuff, and I'm not quite there. I'm in a different sort of arm, more in the cognition side. So
okay.
The term cognition is just a fancy way to say thinking, really.
Yes.
Think about like recognition or things like that. Like when you recognize somebody, it means that you've seen them before. So you are cognizing them. You remember them. The re part is that you're doing it again. So like
You
could say like the first time we met, I cognized you. And the next time we saw each other, I recognized you.
Oh, okay. I got you.
That's how I like
That's
to
a great way
it.
To look at it. Never thought of it that way.
And so that's what cognition is. It's
right.
it's the way we think. And so the things I'm super interested in within cognition are things like memory and false memory, and that leads into things like metacognition, so thinking about thinking.
Okay.
Which I do too much as it is.
I do too.
Yeah, so it's sort of a perfect department for me to be in. And so when I started to get into psychology during undergrad, I had a great advisor who was a learning and memory researcher, and still is. I don't know why I said was. And so his name's Matt Kelly, and so he's at Lake Forest College. And I don't know what I sort of got into through talking to and taking courses from Matt is that I was super interested and very into how we remember, how we think, and I think that it's what draws me in. And so from there, I graduated, and we were talking about what the next step might be.
Right.
And he was saying, you should go to grad school. And I said, I would love to. And so
nice.
I'd love to read more and be a nerd for a longer period of time. Really a long period of time.
Nice.
that's what profs are, right? They're career nerds. And so,
and they're proud of it. They love it.
And I would love to be it someday. So I came here, I sent out a bunch of applications, a couple came back and looked at some things and visited some places, and I came here and I met my supervisor, Steve Lindsay, and my co-supervisor, Liz Brimacombe, and they were excellent, and I met their people, and their students love them, and I said, I think this is going to be a great fit, and so came over, it is a great fit, and it's just sort of gone in from there. So what I've gotten into since arriving has mostly been eyewitness memory. So that's one arm of research that Steve and Liz have conducted together for a number of years now. I've sort of got two projects ongoing at the moment.
Okay.
In one, we are trying to... So I should step back. Most of the research centers around eyewitness identification, actually.
Okay.
So the concept is after somebody witnesses a crime, and this is an uninvolved spectator who happens to see something, so
yes.
Just a pure eyewitness. Often the police will interview them about what happened and then later bring the person back and show them a photo lineup and try to have them choose the actual criminal.
Right.
Okay, and so there's a whole slew of questions and issues that come in when you start to play with all the different little variables that can happen in there, from the actual witnessing to the interview to the time between to the discussions that the police have and how hard they suggest something, to the construction of the lineup itself.
Yes.
So all of these things have been studied ad nauseum, and we still don't really have definitive answers for most things. Psychologists have tried to sort of science-ize the way that that's done, and many precincts have adopted this nice, we call it operationalized, version of lineup administration.
Ah.
And so the term operationalize is a term psychologists use for sort of make objective. So in psychology, there's all these things that you want to measure, but that are totally humanistic. And so it's really difficult to measure how happy somebody is.
Right.
So you can't just say, how happy are you? They're going to say, well, happy how? What do you mean? Like, today I feel fine. Generally, not so fine. You know, it's a totally
It's not a tangible
thing.
Measurement.
Exactly.
Right.
And so one of the many things that some and many psychologists try to do is operationalize things like that. We're trying to objectivize a measure of, in my example right now, happiness, right? So you would ask some people 100 questions and synthesize those in some way to come out with the thing and say, okay, this person is moderately happy. On a scale from 1 to 100, they're 75 or whatever it is. That's operationalized. And so where was I? Let's see.
Well, you were talking about the lineups. And yes, I have to say that for everybody listening, I know that how I relate to that, it's fortunately I haven't had to be a part of a lineup, either the witness or in the lineup, and haven't had that experience. But I have had the experience of being caught in the Criminal Minds and Law and Order TV show marathons ad nauseum. And there are so many shows now where they try to be, I think, as realistic as possible and show that there are many flaws in how an eyewitness sees things. I used to think that, oh yeah, I can totally trust what I saw. Now I'm like, maybe I couldn't. I'm doubtful now.
So, yeah, you're getting a little bit into meta memory and metacognition and false memory in general. So like the question is, can you really trust your memory in certain cases?
Yeah.
And then a whole nother question there is, can other people trust your memory? And I'll get into that in a second. You mentioned the process in general. So when you're talking about how it looks on the TV show and how they seem to be suggesting that, yeah, witnesses aren't all that great at their quote-unquote job as witnesses sometimes. In the early 2000s, a huge research project was published that detailed the number of and the nature of thousands of recent exonerations for formerly imprisoned criminals based on new evidence. And so in most cases, it was things like DNA evidence that came together and released somebody. There's a guy named Ronald Cotton who was wrongfully imprisoned for a long time, and DNA evidence eventually exonerated him. And now he and the woman who wrongfully accused him by choosing him out of a lineup tour together and discuss the questions surrounding around eyewitness identification. So that's a really cool story. If you want to Google Ronald Cotton,
I totally do know.
He's an interesting guy. And then this other thing is the Innocence Project. And so when that was published, they found out there are just thousands of people who were put in jail by eyewitness identification evidence, so being picked out of a lineup, who later were exonerated because they were totally not, they just weren't the person who was there. And so,
and it wasn't because someone was doing it maliciously and lying. This wasn't about framing someone. This was someone totally convinced that that was who they saw and it was wrong.
And so what psychologists have found since then is that there are many, many reasons why that was going on. There are, you can construct a lineup completely unfairly, obviously. There are numerous issues we come into when we start to try to recognize people.
Right.
And there are numerous ways that the police can lean someone toward a certain member. So the way a lineup is constructed is that there is one suspect. So you'll have, say, six people in a photo array, and the police will say, is the person here, and if so, where? There are three possible responses there. There are five. We'll say it like that. So you can have the person actually be in the lineup or not. And so that sort of separates it into two groups. If the real guy is there, then you can pick him correctly. You can falsely pick somebody else, or you can reject the lineup, in this case falsely.
Okay.
Totally, and say he's just not there. If you pick a different dude than the actual suspect, it's essentially like rejecting the lineup, because lineups are always filled with people who look like the criminal but aren't suspected of anything.
Okay.
Because you can't have that kind of did they choose number two or number six? We know it could be either one, and then they
gotcha.
It
wouldn't do any good.
It really messes with the usefulness of the task.
I never realized that, but that makes total sense.
Yeah, that's one of the first cool things that I learned. What they'll do is they'll write out a description. This is to construct a fair lineup. They'll write out the description of the criminal, or the suspect, rather, and they will find other photographs of people who match that description and then fill the lineup out with them. Then on the other side, you could have the wrong person, right? So then that person could be chosen wrongly, hence the Innocence Project.
Yeah.
And then you've got all the other ones, and they could be correctly rejected, or a different foil person could be chosen, et cetera, et cetera. So that's sort of the lineup construction bit. And then there's the method of administration of the lineup. So there's a whole lot of research on how it should be done, whether it should be six photos right at once, whether they should be flipped through like playing cards, sort of, where you would go one to the next and you can't go back And then some districts in Great Britain show little videos of the people, so they show them walking so you can get their gait a little bit. So there's all kinds of questions about what is reasonable for police precincts to use, given some precincts' limitations of funding or however it works, or size, or, you know, just general availability of certain technologies, and how they're going to go after it and how they want to, and whether we're actually suggesting that things that make everything better or that just sort of shift everything along the same kind of line. So I'm getting a little too deep into
it. No, it's actually really interesting. What comes to mind for me is the idea of what would make me not choose the right person? Like, what are some of the things that can interfere with how I remember?
There's 100 ways, right? So I'll just do a couple. So
yeah,
sit down, and if I were a cop, I'd say, all right, which guy do you think it is here? Is it, you think it might be 5 or just the vaguest suggestion? If you say 6 and I go, you sure? Things like that can really affect people. And so then, you know, if you go, well, it's number 6 and I go, you sure it's 6? And you go, maybe 3. Then 3 wasn't your choice. Your choice was 6. And
so you were led.
I sort of led you into 3 because that was my suspect. And so when a cop goes into it, it's tough for them to be. And understandably so.
You've
got your guy, and you believe that he's your guy. There's a reason you're constructing this lineup, because you have some kind of evidence. And so there's actually a whole lot of research now that suggests that blind administration is the best way. So what that means is you get a different cop to actually administer the lineup, so that they don't even do anything, you know, nonverbal. Like, they don't lean in when the person says the wrong thing or...
There are so many things we do non-verbally.
Or all that kind of stuff. Okay, so that's one way.
Okay,
another way I could get you to choose someone who you may not in fair circumstances is surround them with people who don't look like them. So if, in a most extreme example, if I had one guy of one race and then 5 around him of a different race who are not the race of the actual perpetrator, then you're obviously going to pick the guy who fits the description the most.
Yes.
And so,
because there's nobody else fits the description. So of course,
exactly.
That's
no
the extreme example.
No one's
example,
even close.
Right.
But you could even have like a guy with I got mugged the other day by a guy with a big bushy mustache, and I show you 6 photographs. One has a big bushy mustache and the others either, you know, one has a beard, one has no facial hair, one has a pencil mustache or something like that. I'm going to pick the big bushy guy because that's what I remember most about his face.
Right.
Those are two really easy examples
of
easy ways to really mess with people. And then, you know, I sort of hinted at the other race effect and all the different, there's like 1,000 different things that we can get into with that. But the basic takeaway is that there is much, much research on facial identification and memory for faces that suggests that people in general, painting with broadest strokes, are better at identifying and separating out differences between faces within their own race than those in other races.
Well, that makes sense.
There's 100 theories to why, too, right? So
it doesn't mean you're not saying anyone's being racist. It's just the way our minds are working, or our recognition.
You're better at it, simply enough. And it's in most cases, it seems to just be an exposure thing,
an
expertise thing. And there are different featural differences that establish differences between people in different races.
Yeah.
What certain people use to distinguish faces from one another may not work for those of another race, and that's part of what makes it so difficult sometimes.
Well, and I got to believe, too, that the level of trauma that someone experienced in an event...
Oh, sure, there's a good...
Another
thing that could totally screw up your eyewitness identification, yes. So if you've never been around a crime before, if you've never been in any... the stress of it can totally screw you up. There's also a lot of research on gun focus. So if you're robbed, or if you're in a bank heist or whatever it is, when the guy pulls a gun out, you're watching the gun for sure.
Yeah.
And so that really hurts people's ability to identify faces because they stop looking at them. They just watch the gun, make sure it's not pointed at them.
So that's there too. Interesting. Okay. So now you've got all this. What does that take you to? What are you doing?
The grand point of all that is that there's a ton of stuff out there and there's 1,000 ways you could go with it. But most of that is pointed towards helping witnesses become better at being witnesses.
Nice.
So what we're trying to do is help investigators on the other side. So we've got 2 projects that do that.
Nice.
The first is focused on attempting to find some kind of objective measure for whether a witness is good or bad. There are hundreds of attempts at this
as well.
A lot of physical measurements and things like sweaty palms or eye twitching or where your eyes focus and all that kind of stuff. most of it has come out with meager results at
okay.
best. What we're hoping might work soon now is that it seems that it's an individual differences thing. So certain people are better at recognizing other faces than others are. And that I think that you could say that pretty
yeah.
safely. We all have a lot of individual differences in our memory ability and our recognition ability, et cetera, et cetera. What we're thinking is maybe certain people are going to just be naturally better witnesses. And so what we're trying to figure out in one study is whether we can distinguish that in any way. So we basically just have people pretend to be witnesses in a bunch of situations and see whether certain folks are reliably and through time better than other folks.
Well, it would make sense to me because there's different types of intelligences. We all have different combinations and talents, and some
right.
people are just observationally brilliant.
Right.
They might be the ones that are even struggling in school to try in the math and science subjects. And I've seen this in children that have trouble in school, but observationally, they are so good observing, seeing what's going on. It's really interesting.
So that's one study. The other one is sort of a check to see whether investigators do actually have trouble distinguishing good witnesses from poor witnesses. And so what we do is we give them each type and then see how they react differently to each one.
Nice.
And so what we typically find is that they can tell the difference. They know we give them some witnesses who see things really well and some who see things really poorly. And we do that by showing the witnesses good or poor things. In the end, we're curious whether the investigators will notice that difference and then what they'll do with it. And so what we find is that they do notice the difference, but they don't seem to internalize that difference and actually use it to change their personal confidence in their choice of suspect. And
okay.
so what that means is that, they do use it, but they use the witness's information, but not their opinion on the quality of the witness's information.
Okay.
So let's say I give you a lineup, you pick the guy I wanted you to pick, but it doesn't seem like you actually saw anything very well. I'm going to be just as affected by you as I would by another person who did see things really well and still chose my suspect.
Mm.
And so what that means is people who don't see things as well are dramatically affecting the courses of our investigations here.
Right.
And so if that's going on in the real world, it's bad.
Right.
It's something that I think, you know, if we can help officers be better at, we would be helping everybody, of course. And so the next step really in my research is to see whether officers have these kinds of issues as well or whether certain aspects of their training lead them to perform completely differently. I think they will, but it's interesting that non-officers are having this kind of problem. I think it's an important scientific question anyway. And that
yeah.
gets into something what I teased earlier, and that
yeah.
is that our witnesses don't often realize whether we showed them the good view or the poor view. And so later when they identify, sometimes they're certain, sometimes they're not so certain. And that's where it gets tough to remember to trust your own memory sometimes, whether
right.
it's true or false. It looks like that guy, but I'm not sure.
Oh my gosh.
That kind
yeah.
of a situation. And so investigators are doing that for other people every single day. Anyone who interviews and administers lineups on a constant basis is always trying to judge the quality of the memory of that other person. And
that's a skill
and
to be learned, right?
That's what we're saying, yeah.
yeah.
And so it's a skill that UVic undergrads have not learned. And we'd like to meet some actual police officers and see whether they've learned it. And
yes.
if not, what we can do.
Does every university that offers psychology, would they all be having a team that does this particular
oh, yeah.
study?
Oh, no. No, so there's a set of eyewitness memory researchers around the world, like
okay.
you were saying, with Theater and Drama for the Young. It's
yes.
probably a bit wider than I'd imagine Theater
yeah,
and Drama for the Young
Yeah, that one's just a
is.
Really new niche, I guess.
Yeah, and so there's probably, you know, there's like five or six really big names and then a smattering of their students around and other people who've sort of gotten
okay.
into it since then. And they've been at it for a long time. There's been research on eyewitness memory quality and things since, I mean, there's old, really old things that you go, that's totally eyewitness memory, but
oh, yeah.
it's been studied with earnest probably since the 70s or the 80s.
Yes.
So there's a lot of people who are working on it at this point. It's been going for a while, but really with renewed vigor, I think, after the Innocence Project in the early 2000s.
Right.
It's only at those places that you'd find eyewitness memory researchers and research.
So your work has a worldwide impact because it's not that everybody's doing it.
If it works out, yeah.
yeah.
and then I'll get published and go on to fame and fortune, I
nice.
Suppose.
Nice. Okay,
yeah.
great. Oh, well, that's perfect. Well, actually, it's really interesting because I know we're out of time at this point, but I would love to hear more when your research is done. I'm always inviting my guests, like, hey, will you come back and tell? Because this is like really intriguing to me because, like I said, I know I kind of laughed it off, but I am fascinated by all of the crime investigation shows and more about the psychology of and picturing myself in that in those circumstances. And it fascinates me because it just makes me question everything.
Yeah.
And I love it.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, this is great, Marios. Yeah, it's not too often that you and I are in the booth at the same time. So we're going to be doing the thing on the fun drive on March 18th. We're going to be doing it live. We might even throw a little bit of music in there, which is unusual for the two of us.
I think so.
What the heck? It's only half an hour, right?
On one or two.
Yeah. Pitching everybody for a little bit of funds. If you like the show, it helps support the capital funds for this great radio station here. I love CFUV. It's really well run. Love the people here. And
it's an impressive place for sure.
Yeah.
And the capital fund is generally used on things like new equipment, especially.
Yeah.
So
that'll be great.
If you think we sound good now, just wait.
Yes, we'll sound even better. So great. Well, I guess that's where we just end it.
Yeah, yeah. No, well.
See you later. Can't wait for your next interview.
Yeah, good luck. And, Godspeed. And
again, thank you for listening to Beyond the Jargon on CFUV.